Environment and Natural Resources Committee will come to order. Representative Reinhardt, would you like to move the minutes, please?
So moved, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reinhardt moves the minutes for the meeting of February 1st. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes have been adopted. Today we're going to be hearing a presentation from the DNR on their Working Lands Initiative. It's an initiative that's designed to, I think, provide greater efficiency in the way our dollars are being spent for conservation and preservation purposes. And we have two people that are testifying today. We have Dave Shad, who is the director of Fish and Wildlife Division, and we also have Ed Bogus, who is the deputy director of the Fish and Wildlife Division. And if you'd come forward, please, and state your names for the record. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Shad. I'm director of the DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and with me is Ed Bogus, our deputy director of the Fish and Wildlife Division. And we're here to talk about an approach to conservation that we're very excited about and that a lot of our partners that work in the prairie portion of the state are very excited about and engaged in also, and it's called the Working Lands Initiative. It's not a new program, but it's really a new approach to implementing the various programs to do wetland and grassland conservation work in the western and southern areas of the state. I think you're probably all aware of the really significant losses that we've seen in prairie and wetland habitats over time. And because of those losses and the awareness of those losses, there are a lot of programs out there designed to try to get some of that grassland and wetland back on the landscape. We've got programs in the Department of Natural Resources. There's other state agencies. Board of Water and Soil Resources has many programs, and there's a lot of private sector programs out there and federal programs. The problem in the past is that they're all kind of working in their own areas. They're kind of scattergunning those program effects out across the landscape, and they're not as effective as they could be. So what we wanted to do was to bring all these agencies and all these groups that want to do wetland and grassland conservation together to try to focus where they're going to do the work and where it's going to have the most benefit for not only for wildlife but for water quality and flood storage and that kind of thing, and see if we can't get more conservation on the ground for fewer dollars. And based on our work so far, we believe that that's possible. So we've developed a PowerPoint that kind of lays out this approach, talks a little bit about the partners, and then gives a few examples of how we're actually applying these working lands concepts out on the landscape. And I'll turn it over to Ed to walk through that presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, I'm Ed Bogus, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife Deputy Director, and you all should have a copy of the PowerPoint slides. I'm going to quickly work through them, but the Working Lands Initiative was under discussion for actually the last several years with a variety of groups, and it's designed to bring science and shared vision now that we have a lot of data and information on how we approach our habitat management and through the use of computerized geographic information systems and modeling, we can really start to look at where the best potential is for conservation on the land. So the purpose is to use that technology and information to develop a shared vision for wetland and grassland conservation. The groups that have been involved in this effort. It's been a discussion group. It's been open to anyone who wants to come, but they cut across the major conservation agencies, DNR, Fish and Wildlife Service, Board of Water and Soil Resources, Department of Agriculture. Recently, PCA has expressed interest in becoming more involved in this program, but also the private sector, the conservation groups like Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Nature Conservancy, and the farm groups in particular. We've really been trying to tailor this to some of the agricultural groups, and with the idea that all land is working land, we tend to think of that as more of the cropland, but there's also land working for conservation of soil, water, and wildlife. So you can see the kind of the broad cross section of groups that's been working on this, and the recognition that we all need to work together and try to coordinate our approaches as much as possible. We're really applying this ecological modeling through science to boil it down to doing the right things in the right places and getting the most that we can out of our scarce conservation dollars. The people that look at various types of wildlife and their habitat needs have developed some complex formulas to model how ducks, for example, react to the landscape in terms of the amount of wetland and grassland that's available. And this can be applied through geographic information systems to look at the existing landscape in Minnesota. And this is looking in the Prairie Pothole region of southern and western Minnesota. And you can see the darker red and yellow colored areas would according to the modeling, have the highest potential for duck nesting. And that's based on the amount of wetland and grassland that's in the landscape right now. That along with modeling for other species helps us to look at how we can focus our conservation efforts. This is kind of a hypothetical slide that illustrates how we can use this technique to target conservation efforts in a way that produces more wildlife on fewer acres and with lower investment than just opportunistically scattering conservation across the landscape. If you look on the left-hand side, you can see that with 87,000 acres of targeted conservation in these complexes, the modeling shows we could expect over 7,000 ducks recruited into the population versus 113,000 acres scattered and not focused. We would have 30% less or so recruitment of wildlife there. We can also do this for other species besides waterfowl. Pheasants, obviously being year-round residents of the state, have some wintering, winter cover and winter food needs that waterfowl that migrate through the state don't have, where the waterfowl have the migration habitat needs that pheasants don't have. So, and then there's a variety of non-game species, and this these habitat needs and requirements on a year-round basis can be modeled through this geographic information system approach to look at where the best potential is, and we can start to group some of these and really start to target and focus on conservation efforts. We're not the only ones doing this. This is an example of priority areas that were established by the Natural Resource Conservation Service for the Wetland Reserve Program that show how they scored applicants depending on which class of priority area the landowner fell in, with the highest points going to the areas that had the most potential on the wildlife scale of their scoring system. For the Working Lands Initiative, we looked at modeling for a variety of game and non-game species and native prairie and shallow lake needs that are listed here. And we also looked at developing complexes that meet some minimum size requirements. They need to be in this 4 to 9 square mile category. They need a minimum for wetland dependent species of 20% total wetland, and then a range between 40% at a minimum and 60% at a maximum grassland. And then in the pheasant range, we need to also have the winter cover and winter food available. So this is the kind of the basis of the complexes that we're trying to create or enhance within the focus areas. Put this all together, and the areas that show up in gray on this map are the areas that have the highest potential. These are the top 25% when we look at 40-acre cells. And so then these form the nucleus for targeting our conservation programs within these county areas. And what we've done in the past biennium, we've started a pilot of the Working Lands Program. We had some some heritage money, which is funding the Game and Fish Fund that's comes from lottery in lieu of tax money that was targeted to this effort in a pilot program this last session. We went out in some representative counties across the prairies and met with some local teams to form some focus areas. We identified 12 counties. 11 of these focus areas were organized, and one of the keys to this is that it's not only geographically focused, but local teams, interdisciplinary and interagency teams, are the ones that really then start to identify where the conservation opportunities are. So these focus area counties were identified to pilot this approach to conservation. The local teams mostly came from the state and federal agencies, some of the local SWCDs, in some cases watershed districts. Some of the teams, there was real active involvement from county commissioners and landowners. And within the 12 counties that we had held these organizational meetings, we had 11 focus area teams that actually identified some proposals. This is an example in Murray County of some of the work that one of the local teams did, where you can see in the areas that are outlined in the kind of purple color on these maps are the target areas within the focus area. So the focus area just sets the broader geographic area. These target areas are really the ones that are based on the application of the science and the modeling that I talked about earlier. And they're looking at areas that have existing grassland and wetland where they can start to build those complexes that meet those minimum 49 square mile sizes with the at least 20% wetland and 40 to 60% grassland criteria. So it doesn't necessarily have to have that to begin with, but it has to have the potential to get to those criteria. And these are the areas where there's already the nucleus to start to focus that effort. Those focus area teams developed project proposals and submitted them. We only had limited amount of funding available for this for the actual projects over the 2 years. We had about $600,000 appropriation per year, but for the actual funding of the team's proposals, we had $800,000 total for the biennium, and we had over $4.5 million in requests from the teams for projects ranging from biomass production to alternative crops, grazing assistance, exotic species control, controlled drainage, and then a lot of them were sign-up incentives for various easement programs where the rental rate that the programs were offering maybe wasn't enough to compete with other land rental rates, so we offered incentives through this program.
Excuse me, there is a question. Representative Wergenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said that you were spending $600,000 from in each of the last 2 years. Did I get that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wergenius, I believe it was $600,000 a year for the whole Wetland Prairie initiative that we got funded last session. Some of that went for monitoring of wetlands
and for
prairie, for enhanced prairie bank programs.
What I'm trying to figure out, if I could, is how many acres then did we add to a good wetland did we add with that amount of money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wergenius, it's still a work in progress at this point, so we don't have the money is still being committed as we speak, because we're still in this biennium and a lot of it's going on contract. It'll be available for use in the year following the end of the biennium under the contract. So we don't have those totals right now. And this is also, you know, more of a way of doing business than funding projects per se. So what we're hoping is that we'll influence a lot more acres than we actually fund, so that there will be a multiplier benefit, not just us funding acres of practices on the ground, but using this approach to leverage and target work by Ducks Unlimited, Citizens Forever, Water, Water, and Soil Resources, and others, so that it won't, the accomplishments won't just be from the expenditures of this program. They'll be multiplied several fold over that.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Williams.
Still, it would be helpful to have some notion of what outcomes we are going to get from these dollars as we look for doing more. What is it that happens? So, as folks are asking for more dollars, and I think there's just a general sense that everybody wants to do more for wetlands. I haven't gotten anything but that. But I don't know what this means in terms of our wetlands. And maybe if we had some help with that later, that would be good.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we'll work on trying to put this into that context. And we will be referencing this again as we get into the budget discussions in your committee. So we'll have it by then.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Vargas. And Representative Saylor has a question as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I just would like to have you elaborate, if you could, a little bit more on what your project or project proposals are for biomass production. I'm wondering how, basically in lieu of information that we've had in the last week about how we're looking at new energy from kind of second-generation ethanol and with switchgrass and prairie grasses, how you've incorporated that or begun to incorporate those considerations into your plans. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, we think we're just now in the early stages of exploring that idea. The agencies and the partners that are involved in the Working Lands Initiative have a lot of experience working with farmers, working with the agricultural community, and in getting grass out on the land and getting it planted. We've been doing this for years. The energy folks that are now looking at grass as a source of energy are kind of new to this game, and so we think this whole biofuels issue is an area where energy interests, agricultural interests, and conservation interests are going to kind of come together and have to work together to make this happen. And we think this model, this working lands model, where we bring all these different programs, all these tools to these local areas and say, here's some ways that we can work with these lands to either get grass established or to identify lands that are in existing programs, for example, on state wildlife management areas or federal waterfowl areas, and make those available for energy use. So it's kind of a model of bringing people together at that local level, and you could, for example, organize a working lands team around the location of an energy plant, for example, and say, we'd like to do some conservation work in this area, and this energy interest has a need for grass to fuel the plant. Let's work together. It's in all of our interests to get more grass out on the land, and we think the conservation programs, conservation interests can bring a lot to the table to make that happen.
Representative Scalzi also has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question also in line with Representative Wagenius's question. I'm just kind of curious as well how much, I mean, when you come back with your information on that, I think it would be very helpful to know how much a ballpark estimate of what we've done so far. But also in that developed project proposals, where I see the exotic species control. And I'm wondering if you can let us know which exotic species you're talking about there, and also if a portion of that would be in exotic species prevention rather than control. And are there any efforts in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, I'm not sure off the top of my head which exact species. These would have been primarily terrestrial exotic species like Russian olive and things like that in the prairies, I believe, but I don't know for sure all the species that were involved. We could certainly get back to you on that. Our our specialist who worked to pull all this together couldn't be here this afternoon, and we'd have the answer for you here today, but we can certainly get back on that. And as far as prevention, certainly that's something that we're working on, both on the aquatic and the terrestrial side, is how we can better tailor programs to prevent spread of exotics in the future before we have to control them. So that is something that we're interested in. But a lot of what these teams came up with had to deal with invasive species in the prairies.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking through here, and I didn't see any reference to all the wetlands and easements that were purchased with the federal duck stamp money. How are they, what's the overlay here with those easements? Are we working to make sure those easements are protected and part and parcel of what we're doing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lagunas, those easements are considered, as we're looking at this, we're looking at federal easements, state rim easements, as well as acquired lands and farm program lands. So all of those are being looked at as part of the package here.
Representative Lagunas.
I don't know what looked at means. What are we... do you track where those wetlands are to make sure that those easements are being followed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the federal easements are administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, so they're in our database so that as we're looking at one of these target areas, we can see where there's waterfowl production areas, wildlife management areas, easements, Fish and Wildlife Service easements. All of that fits into the mix of the amount of wetland and grassland and whether we're meeting those minimum criteria. As far as whether the easement conditions are being followed and the condition of the easements and all that, that's administered through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So DNR is not specifically looking at the quality of those easements or the compliance.
Representative Guinness.
However, since those easements exist and they're a huge acreage and we need that acreage, do you have any way to interface with the federal government and say, hey, we're working on the ground and we see that the landowner is not complying with this easement? Do you follow through on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Guinness, we do work very closely with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they're a major partner in this effort, and we do work, you know, across the jurisdictions. If one of us sees something that you know needs to be brought to attention, the other one, we certainly do that. And we're, through our enforcement efforts, we're starting to look more at Wetland Conservation Act compliance. So there's certainly avenues for that sort of thing to be occurring right now.
Please continue with your presentation.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to some kind of on-the-ground examples of what we're talking about. This is Lake Moriah, working lands target area. This is one that's been a major focus from a variety of perspectives. There's been a lot of work on the actual lake itself with Ducks Unlimited and DNR and the Wetland Rally contributors and so forth. And this is now also a target area for Working Lands Initiative. And you can see Lake Moriah there kind of in the upper center of the slide. And the target area is, the purple area there. There's some proposed acquisitions and some prep area identified. If we zoom in a little bit more just on the lake itself and kind of that eastern side, you can see where a combination of factors are being brought together. We've got some wetland restoration, some of the land that was actually part of the lakeshore itself without a cropping history wasn't eligible for some of the federal farm programs, but it's been enrolled through some of the rim easement programs so that we've been able to use a variety of programs to bring more of a one-stop shopping effort to this this ownership to provide protection for that whole eastern side. We're looking at some other options on the western side of the lake. So this is one example using some easements and some acquisition. Looking at another example in the Fenmont target area of Murray and Nobles counties. Again, the target areas, and you can see there's also a little piece of another target area up in the upper right corner, but focusing in on this area, one of the things that the local teams identified there that they thought would be very important was sustainable grazing, using some rotational grazing on some of the wildlife areas where we're constantly challenged with being able to manage the grass on our wildlife areas. We do a lot of it through prescribed burning, but we're also interested in grazing these grassland systems, of course, evolved under grazing and a fire regime, and where we can bring grazing back into the mix. It can provide multiple benefits for the grass, the wildlife, and for the local farmers. So this is an example where we're helping to facilitate some use of grazing to manage grass on some of our wildlife areas to the benefit of the local conservation programs as well as local agricultural programs. We're also doing some things with what we're calling managed drainage or conservation drainage, where one of the biggest losses for wetlands across the prairie pothole region has been the very shallow type 1 and type 2 that are only wet for a short period of time in the spring. Those are very important food sources and pair formation wetlands, but they're, because of the shallowest, they're also the ones that were easiest to drain, and some of this approach looks at actually keeping water on some of those fields longer, especially under a corn regime where they don't need to plant as early, allowing that invertebrate base and the pair formation to take place in some of those shallow wetlands, and then taking the water off a little closer to planting and hopefully providing some benefits for ducks. And this is something that's more experimental right now. We're going to be doing some evaluation, but it's a way, again, to work with the agricultural community out there to provide some benefits. So,
excuse me, Mr. Vargas. Representative McNamara has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vargas, if I go back to you had one slide there where you had the fence and the cattle. I was on it was actually a federal U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lands this fall out in Big Stone County, and I noticed it had been grazed this summer with the cattle, so I'd imagine they do similar to you. But the one thing I did notice is there had been a fair amount of ATV traffic within, and it almost looked like, I'm wondering if the farmer ended up needing to use his ATV to make sure the calves weren't in the bulrushes or something, because it really looked, do you allow them, what kind of arrangements do you make with the farmer to kind of spell out what they can do?
Mr. Boggs?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, Fish and Wildlife Service has been using rotational grazing on their waterfowl protection areas more than we have on our wildlife management areas. So we're relatively limited in what we've been doing with it. I'm not aware that we've authorized ATVs for herding the cattle, if that's what they were doing. But the way that we would look at this is there's going to be some temporary, apparent loss of habitat value, hunting value to some of these areas as they're grazed or burned. But you get, over the longer term, you get improvements in those stands and better values for wildlife by allowing these practices. So what we would be looking at is making sure that we're not doing entire areas at one time, that we're kind of rotating this around, doing it periodically, so that we're not compromising the values of the entire areas, every year.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you say that you would allow a farmer to have an ATV to herd their cattle on a WMA?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, we don't allow ATVs except on wildlife management areas, except under very specific conditions, and I don't even know that our rules would. We do permit it for people with disabilities, and there's some exceptions up in the Canton areas on certain lands or certain trails. But it's the general rule for wildlife management areas is no ATVs. I'm not certain. Maybe Dave knows how that would apply in a situation where, you know, we don't allow tractors either. But obviously, if we have a cooperating farmer, we do under certain contracts or permits. So I'm not certain what the answer is. If it's a farming arrangement on a wildlife area, that's a little bit different than a public use. So we'd have to check into that. Unless Dave has the answer, so we can get back to you on that.
What?
But it's not normally allowed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Boggs. I guess if you would get back, I'm just curious to know. I mean, this does happen to be one that did have a food plot, so I know they certainly had the farmer on there with a tractor. But there seemed to be a lot of damage by the ATV that I really questioned what, and it looked to me like it was in the area where he was trying to find cattle, is what I could surmise.
We'll do some checking and get back to you. So just to wrap up, Mr. Chairman and members, the working lands is not a new program. It's really just trying to focus not only our approaches in DNR, but our partners to focus on complexes and use the science that we have on what the needs of wildlife and what the existing cover is out there. To have it be locally driven by these local teams and to try to stimulate and reward innovation through some of these things we talked about with more use of, for example, rotational grazing or manage drainage within existing farming operations. So with that, that concludes our presentation. If there are more questions, we'd be happy to answer the questions.
Any other questions? Well, thank you for your presentation, and I think we're moving in the right direction with the Working Lands Initiative. I appreciate the work that you're doing and working with landowners and to utilize these lands in a more efficient way. The next thing that we're going to be doing today is considering a bill, and Representative Dill, can you move the bill, please?
Ms. Chair, I'd like to move House File 415 for Representative Poppy. That's a noise standard exemptions modified, and move the bill.
Okay. Representative Dill moves that House File 415 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. So, Representative Poppy, thanks for joining us today, and to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Egan and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Dill. I'm Jean Poppy, State Representative from District 27B in southern Minnesota. I'm here before you presenting House File 415, a bill that would exempt car racetracks built between 1983 and 1996 from the state noise standard. Currently, the law reads all tracks built before 1983 are exempt from state noise standards, and this bill brings newer racetracks, including one in my district, into the same exemption. From the viewpoint of the racetrack owner of Deer Creek Speedway in my district, this is a fairness issue. Also included in this bill is language designed to protect the racetrack business, preventing civil suits based solely on noise to be brought under the nuisance law. The racetrack owner in my district and racetrack owners and operators throughout the state of Minnesota are concerned that future claims based on noise could be used to shut down their business or operations and dramatically affect the economic health of the racetrack and the surrounding communities. Deer Creek Speedway is a racetrack that has become one of the premier racing facilities in the Midwest. This growth in popularity has come through the investment by the family who owns the racetrack. It should be noted the current owners were not the original owners of the racetrack. The Queensland family, the current owners who own this racetrack, have continued to upgrade the facility to mitigate the noise that is generated. One of the latest policies will be put into place in the upcoming 2007 racing season. I will have my testifier speak to the improvements they have made over the years. With me today is Randy Queensland, owner of Deer Creek Speedway, located near Racine, Minnesota. He will speak about the necessity of the language in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poppy, and Mr. Queensland, if you'd state your name for the record, please.
My name is Randy Queensland, Deer Creek Speedway.
And if you'd like to testify to the bill?
Yes, sir. I do have a handout. While they're handing that out, a little bit of the front cover of this would give you just a little bit of idea of the setting of our facility. My family, my wife, my three sons, and daughter-in-law purchased it 5 years ago. This will be our sixth year. We're located about 15 miles south of Rochester, Minnesota, on U.S. Highway 63. It's a very rural setting. As you can see in the picture, you see the racetrack itself. To the left is also a campground, which is part of our facility. And adjoining it directly on the top of the picture is a 40-acre parcel of an antique tractor association there. Just so you understand the setting, there are approximately 10 homes within a half mile of our facility and approximately 20 homes within a mile. We have a very rural setting, probably one of the most rural settings of any tract within the state of Minnesota. On page 2, one of the sanctioning bodies that we do belong to, and I am a member of, is called WSOTA Promoters Association. The Promoters Association are not unaware of noise situations. They're doing things to also help this. One of the things they're doing is they're lowering the decimal level of the cars required to run on the tracks. We fought very hard to help this to be accomplished. We feel this fix needs to come from both ends. And this is one thing the association is doing. In their current rule book, it read 100 decimals at 100 feet on a meter is what they did. They lowered that a total of 5 decimals is what they did, which we feel will be very significant and help in this matter considerably. WSOTA is one of the largest sanctioning bodies in the Midwest, probably the largest in Minnesota, and will affect a large portion of the racing that takes place in the state. On the second page, on the right-hand side, we also have a very good working relationship with our county commissioners. For the last 2 years, we've provided our county with what we call plan of actions and relationships of neighbors. And our county has accepted this. They feel we're doing a very good job with this. We listed some of the items that were implemented in 06. We also have a few more I didn't add to the list. We had this in 05. One of the key things we do is monitor our finish times. What our county found was, in researching other counties, most counties tend to regulate racetracks with curfews and time. So according to our county, they were very, very significantly wanted to know what time our races were completed. These fall within the acceptance of our commissioners. I apologize. He was going to be here today and testify to this, but he couldn't make it. He would plan to do so at another date. On the third page, again, it talks about the racetracks in Minnesota. There are 34 racetracks or race facilities in the state of Minnesota, which 31 are exempt from the noise statute, and we are one of three that are not, which Representative Poppy addressed is one of the issues. Part of the fix here would bring the three of us in compliance with the rest within the state, and that's one thing we are seeking. The other portion is to exempt, even though they're exempt from the noise statute, it does not exempt anybody, any racetrack, from being sued civilly. And this is the other part of the bill we are requesting. We currently have had charges brought against us on the first part for not being exempt from the noise statute. We also have been sued civilly. And this is a very critical thing to us. As the first portion is a misdemeanor, it's very serious. Second portion, being the civil, is pretty devastating to the future of our facility and operation. That also, we feel, would have repercussions across the entire state of Minnesota, as this could be a potential problem for every track within the state. Again, continuing on to the next page, we did have an economic impact study done on our facility. We've got some numbers there to share with you, and I would address any questions you may have on these numbers. We also showed a smaller market from KRA on the right side, which is a facility in western Minnesota. There's just some statistics for you to share there in regards to the racetracks. The remaining page on the back actually shows some aerial photos of different facilities in the state of Minnesota. Our facility would be Spring Valley, Minnesota. And like I mentioned to you, directly north of our facility is a camp facility. In the middle of the picture is actually an antique tractor association's property. And within that picture, I believe there's a total of 4 residents in that entire picture. If you look at some of the other examples, which these pictures are 4 to 5 years old, additional housing developments have cropped up around. We feel there's a potential problem for all these facilities in the state of Minnesota if we're not successful with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Queensland. Yes, Representative Lagunias.
Yes, I'm trying to understand. There are 3 more facilities that, and there are 5 listed, and so I don't know which ones will be exempt under your when you change from 83 to 96. Which are the 3 that we're talking about?
On that particular picture, I'm sorry,
Mr. Queensland.
Mr. Chairman, the one under Spring Valley, Minnesota, in that particular picture is the only one of those 5. The other 2, back on the second page, Fergus Falls and Sauk Rapids. If you go back to the second page, it would be Spring Valley, Sauk Rapids, and Fergus Falls. The picture with the 5 aerials were just random pictures to explain the density of housing in relationship, rural residents in relationships to racetracks.
Representative Lagunias.
Okay, so I understand which folks are involved in the changing of the dates, but when you change and say events are exempt from state standards, then all of the tracks that we're talking about are included. Do I have that right?
Currently, the other 4 that are photographed here are currently exempt. So the Spring Valley one is one of the 3 that is not currently exempt. So trying to add that one to the exemption.
Representative Lagunias.
No, my question is not that. It's when you then go on to your next sentence and say folks are exempted from claims based on noise brought under statutes, then that is beyond the 3. It is then all of these and others, if I'm understanding correctly, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly.
That's correct.
Poppy.
So the 2 different pieces affect 2 different groups of racetracks.
Yes, the date will impact the 3 that are not currently exempt, and the additional language would take care of all of the racetracks and all of the racing operations that happen throughout the state.
Any further? Representative Mariani.
Thank you. I have a question. Now, this is only in regards to not the ones that we're trying to add here, but those who are currently currently covered by current statute. So I guess that would be 1983 and prior. Can you tell us, what the current status is in regards, or what the current status and or recent history has been in regards to any of those in regards to being subject to civil suits? In other words, I'm focusing in on that new language, the 918 through 20, and I'm trying to get a sense of what kind of level of activity exists out there for those tracks in terms of being subject to claims. Is it a big problem? Is it a small problem? Does it happen quite often? Is it rare?
Mr. Queensland.
Mr. Chairman, most tracts have, they work with being good neighbors and work with noise issues on a regular basis. Most tracts have felt they're exempt from noise. In talking with different tract promoters and different owners. There was some case here a number of years ago involving a gun club and a civil lawsuit that opened up some eyes to some people that these types of things are not exempt from civil suits. I think it was 2001, 2002. We can get you the data on that. We now have been sued civilly. Many promoters are extremely concerned that if their individuals around their tracts understand they can sue them civilly, that this will be a domino effect around the state of Minnesota. And there lies the fear. I hope I'm answering your question.
Well, Representative Mariani.
Sure, thank you. Sort of. I mean, it sounds like you're trying to propose an approach to, you know, let's kind of be preventive here in terms of folks that may want to up the ante, if you will, in terms of civil claims. But what I was getting at is what has been the recent history in terms of is it more often than not that a tract like is facing or has faced suits by civil suits locally?
I think that it's more often than not, thank you, Mr. Chair, that they have not faced this. But it comes to light for Mr. Queensland and his family because they have been sued civilly. So that's why this issue is up. But they also were not previously exempt from the noise standard.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I was just curious about, you mentioned a lawsuit dealing with a gun club. I had a civil lawsuit brought against it. What was the outcome? Do you know the outcome of that civil suit?
It's my understanding the individual was successful over the gun club.
Thank you, Mr. Queensland. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, is there anyone here from the Pollution Control Agency who deals with the noise standard? I have a question looking at precedents here. If we have any other examples of exemptions from civil litigation regarding the noise. For example, has the legislature acted to exempt gun clubs from civil litigation? I'm looking for any precedent that may be out there.
Hi, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and position.
My name is Brian Timerson. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Now, your question related to gun clubs, is that correct?
My question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
My question is, do we have any other examples in law where we have exempted from noise pollution standards groups or entities or businesses from litigation? Like what is being asked in 1.18, 1.19, 1.20.
Mr. Tyreson?
Mr. Chair, Representative? No, we don't. We have other areas like skeet and gun clubs that are exempt from the state noise rules, but we don't have other areas in 116.07 that exempt them from other statutes.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the one in Alexandria, and if I am remembering correctly where that is, it's right in the city of Alexandria, and this is at the Douglas County Fairground. Am I getting that right?
Mr. Queensland,
Mr. Chairman, that'd be correct.
Representative Arginius.
I've gone to the Douglas County Fairground many times for the county fair, obviously. And here's why I'm troubled by your second sentence in your proposal. This is a very populated area. It's an area that has, where the housing is old, where people are older. It's not just brand new housing. People have lived there for many, many, many years. And so to say that those folks who've lived there for many, many, many years will no longer have any rights is troubling, because there is no then good reason to be careful of your neighbors. And I am maybe more super sensitive to this issue than a lot of legislators at the table, except for perhaps Representative Hansen, but my district borders on the airport. And because it borders on the big airport that you all come in and out of all the time, and it's governed by federal law, not state law, there is no constraint on the noise at that airport. And it has made a lot of people's lives miserable as the airport has grown with that. Folks, the housing stock is old in my neighborhood. I mean, it's even before probably practically planes were envisioned, but that's an exaggeration a bit. But my house, for example, was built in 1929. That airport was not active then. But now it is a major problem because the airport was allowed to grow without control. So I caution members about this. When all rights go to one side and there's no balance, there is a fairness issue when we're taking rights from one person and giving them all to another person. And I see this as going to a committee that will deal with legal matters, but generally speaking, we don't take all rights away from one group and give them to another group. We are more balanced. And I'm just aware of this because in my neighborhood, there is no balance. There is no restraint, and people don't feel guilty flying in and out of the airport and over my house and over the houses of all of our neighbors. And there is no constraint. So as you all are thinking about this, think about the other people who are going to be impacted, not in your rural area where you're away from people, but in all the other neighborhoods that are around these other racetracks.
Mr. Queensland.
Mr. Chairman, we've visited with our county commissioners in that regard. They feel they do have restraints on us. They feel they will, if we don't be good neighbors, my understanding is the curfews they can put on us could be pretty substantial. Regulations and things they could do to us, different than an airport that operates 24/7. My understanding, our commissioners have a strong hand on us yet, on many, many aspects of running our facility, and we feel we will have to abide by many regulations yet.
Representative Breinart. Thank you. Representative Hackbarth.
I pass.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, when I was approached by this bill, I told them I'd support it, and I asked a specific question if future racetracks would have to come under or would be exempted. And I didn't like the idea of future racetracks. I was told no, but I see here, now I understand the first part, but when you get to line 1.18, from there on, would this mean that a racetrack that's going to be built near Lake Crystal and mine, possibly, that they've applied for a permit for, would that mean if we enacted this law that they would be exempt from civil suits?
You bet.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Representative Cornish, Mr. Chair. I would say that that pertains to those racetracks that fall within that 1996 or before. I'm not an attorney, but it would, because motor vehicle race events exempted from state standards would be those, but I guess I would defer perhaps to Mr. Helland, who maybe would be better able to answer that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I could get that clear in my mind, if line 118 through 120 if that doesn't exempt, I don't want the racetrack exempted that it's going to be built up there. I thought we were just talking about ones that were already built, but a future racetrack, like from here on, that isn't built yet, would that, those three sentences or those three lines, would that exempt the future racetrack from those claims?
Mr. Helen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, no, it's only the racetracks that are in operation before 1996, not future ones.
Thank you, Mr. Helen. And Representative Olin?
He answered that part of it. The other part, when we talk about Alexandria, now that is in the city limits. Do you know of any noise suits or ever, anybody ever sued Alexandria's racetrack at all?
Mr. Queensland.
Mr. Chairman, none that I am aware of. I am aware of they work off a time ordinance, is my understanding, and I know our county has talked to their county, the commissioners, and has their information and regulated on time, but I'm not aware of one.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for either Representative Poppy or Mr. Queensland. Representative Poppy explained to me the other day the process that you've gone through in order to get this far, mitigation efforts that you've already done, noise mitigation, concessions that you've made to the surrounding landowners to this point. Either would you or Representative Poppy be willing to kind of summarize those for the committee?
I will ask Mr. Queensland to do that. I will just mention a couple of things. One is, as he talked about on the second page, I think he sort of skimmed over it maybe, but the decibel limit that will be changed now, that's because the cars will be required to have mufflers, which has been a concern. The neighbors certainly have been kept up maybe some nights because of the noise from the cars without mufflers, and that really is the WSOTA standard now, that those cars will have mufflers that will reduce the decibel limit. So that's the latest thing that will be now added in for the 2007. And I think that he can speak to maybe some of the berming and the billboard. I'll ask him to do that.
Right. Mr. Queensland?
Chairman, on page 2, on the right-hand side, as the Representative Poppy noted, one of the larger items done lately was you get the largest sanctioning body in the area to lower their decimal levels. We're currently talking to other sanctioning bodies to do the same, but we have this one enacting it this year. The plan there, one, earlier start times, definitely, so we don't run later. Very sensitive to time. Eliminate some classes, and again, this is all helps to shorten up the event to make it get over earlier. Continue to run fewer support classes for special events. Times, what we have found and our county commissioners found in their research is the time is, you know, hold it to a reasonable show and get it done by a reasonable hour. And that's one thing we've worked very hard to do. Number 6 is we did install a large wall, 16 feet high, 230 feet long, in the direction of the neighbor that has had the highest level of problems. And this we did last year. There's been no testing done since this went up to see what these levels are. And at the very bottom, you can see the largest sensitive thing is to get your event done at a reasonable time. We also, any complaint, any phone call, since we've ever owned the track, if we get from anybody, we go communicate and talk to and work this out. We meet with our county commissioners. They go over our plan. Our commissioner does. He okays our plan, and then we go implement.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Queensland, you may or may not have the information, but I'm just curious. I'm looking at the pictures here. How many of these houses were built before the racetrack, and how many of them were built after the racetrack was put in?
Mr. Queensland.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. I don't have the answer. It's a lot of both. Many of these pictures, like I mentioned, are 4 or 5 years old. If you got current ones, they're built in considerably closer and around them than even these pictures show. We might be the exception with ours because of our setting. But there are a lot of them that have had a lot of developments moved in around them. And the major concern and problem coming is these tracks are fearful of being able to to function and operate with constant threat of someone that could bring a civil lawsuit up and possibly shut them down. The problem we have is primarily 1,500 feet from our racetrack, over a quarter mile away. And the point I'm trying to make here is many of these have hundreds of homes that are within hundreds, 500 feet, 700 feet, half the distance of ours. So if we're having a problem here and being sued civilly, what's going to be the devastation around the state of Minnesota with the density of homes if we don't do something?
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the rest of these tracks that people have built homes near them could not be sued civilly because they were built before 1983. Is that correct, Mr. Queensland, or not?
Mr. Queensland.
Chairman, no, in fact, that is the major, major problem here. Every single track in the state could be sued civilly. And like I pointed out, our case, our particular rural residence is 1,500 feet away from our track, which is a long ways compared to many of these. We run the same cars these tracks run. And the way our suit was brought up, it's in their place of enjoyment. The decimal level is allowed over what is set by the state, which I don't have a meter, but I'm probably talking at the allowable level right now. And all these tracks are subject to having that happen. We've had it where it's not even, it's at many different hours of the night that they tested it and the levels. And the levels are fairly low. And a compromise, I personally feel, needs to be done. The cars need to be a little quieter. That's happening. And the decimal level is the biggest problem we see is what we can produce as noise under our zoning is one level. And Mr. Timmerman, he's here, he can probably correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sorry. The level that is in a rural residence of enjoyment is way down here. And that can be a stone throw away. And that can cause a civil lawsuit and be devastating to the operation of every tract in the state. That's the one rub we're looking to try to fix.
Okay. Any other questions at all? Representative Scalzi?
Yes, I did have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Okay, now I'm really confused because Mr. Helen said it was only these three tracks, and yet you're telling us that it's all the tracks. So this particular bill, does it affect all the tracks like he says, or just the three that you said? I just would like a clarification of that.
A portion of it deals with only those three tracks, the first portion, but the portion dealing with lawsuits deals with tracks prior to 1996, all the tracks prior to 1996. Is that correct, Mr. Holland?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any other questions at all? Mm-hmm. Okay. Next on the list, we do have two individuals who want to testify, I believe, in opposition to this bill. Ms. Debbie and Mr. Gary Gettleman in the audience, if you could step forward, please. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Gettleman. Am I pronouncing that correct? Okay. Okay, if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Debbie Gettleman. I live at 7889 255th Street, Spring Valley, Minnesota. Sounds like a big address, but yes, we do live out in the boonies, almost. Some of the people that our neighbors wanted to come, but due to family and children, they were not able to. So what I'm going to do, and I hope you bear with me, I'm going to read a couple excerpts from their letters. I believe they sent all of you letters, but they did get responses back stating that since they were not in your representative district, you basically will not read them unless you have time. And we all know you're very busy, so here I go. This is from Lori Miller. She used to be a neighbor of ours. And Okay. Sorry, I can't touch that. I am an educated as a geologist. I am appalled that Moore County and the MPCA have ignored and passed off this issue for so long. You've got to understand, we've been fighting the racetrack for 10 years. Well, now 11. So this isn't a new thing to any of us. Maybe Mr. Queensland, but not to us. It doesn't take a science degree to realize that the track was built and continues to operate in a floodplain. And consequently, the consequences for flooding and noise pollution impacts far beyond the garbage washed down the river. After being ignored by local, county, and state level, we moved 7 miles from the track. We were new in Minnesota. I'm trying to cut out most of the letters. We are new to Minnesota in 1985 and purchased a home and then a peaceful, beautiful neighborhood. We were welcomed to the neighborhood and raised two small girls there. It still makes me angry that we had to move. They basically sold their house. They had two houses for 6 months, and they finally sold it to a family that sons raised. And I know for a fact that they took a substantial loss on their house. If it were not for the track, we would still be there. I am writing this letter so that you do not overlook matters concerning the racetrack. I will never forget what the racetrack has done to our lives. Please go and listen sometime and think of what this would be like living close by. We still hear it 7 miles away. It is that loud. This one is from Mr. Ben Fangen. He is with the DOT, and he's out plowing snow in southern Minnesota because we got a lot of it. Currently, there are two legal cases involving Deer Creek Speedway, a criminal matter in Moore County. It's called Deer Creek Speedway and Randy Queensland versus the state, and Gary Gettleman, which is my husband and myself, versus Deer Creek Speedway and Moore County District File Number, blah, blah, blah. This includes 15 neighbors that have gotten together because of their homes are being rattled constantly. The speedway is located on the river bottom of Deer Creek, which is the start of the middle branch of the Rut River Basin system in southeast Minnesota. The middle branch of the river was designated by the Minnesota Fishing Regulations that all trout streams in this must be immediately returned to the water. All trout in this stream must be immediately returned to the water. The pit area of the racetrack is in a floodplain. From May 1st, 2006 to September 30th, 2006, we had approximately 20 inches of rain. When it rains, all the rain runs into the middle of the oval, which very slanted track of the speedway. The track is built of dirt, which absorbs the oil and gasoline from the accidents and the track, along with the pollutants from the car's exhaust, which seeps into our groundwater. The speedway dirt track must be contaminated soil. At the time, the noise pollution from the Deer Creek Speedway is unbearable, even in our super-insulated house located 1 mile northeast of the track. Mr. Mangan works for the Minnesota DOT. He has worked for the state for 37 years. He was called out on 2:30 a.m. on September 15, 2004, and he saw for himself the pile of tires and cars underwater. We had a regular flood for that day. The speedway pit is located in an area that must have been under 8 to 10 feet of water. He called the DNR to file a complaint. The DNR agency said they would send someone down to check out the complaint and called Vince about their findings. He is still waiting for the call. His last paragraph, and this isn't mine, but this is his: "We are appalled that our Senator Dan Sparks and Representative Gene Poppe, both Democrats, are supporting Deer Creek Speedway, the biggest polluter in the area of Frankfort Township, located in eastern part of Moore County. This is a good example how apathetic our lawmakers have become concerning our precious environment. Our air, water, and our land are not things to take lightly." And this is from Vince and Laura Vangen from Spring Valley. Others, I have a whole list of others, but I'm just going to give you different excerpts. This is from a neighbor that's about half a mile from me. "Forget about enjoying nice summer nights outside with your family around the campfire. It's too loud to do anything already. We love it here in the country and miss the nice quiet weekends when we could be outside with our family and friends. Now it's too noisy to hear each other. We have lived here for 36 years and have never had problems with our neighbors until now, with the noise that comes from Deer Creek Speedway. I can't enjoy having company over to grill out because it's so loud. I cannot carry on a conversation. The noise affects my daily life as well as much of the area. We have less and less wildlife in the area because of the noise. The ditches are full of litter, too. These are handwritten letters from my neighbors. Now you get me. First of all, I'd like to tell you that we have never asked Deer Creek Speedway to shut down. We have lived in our home for 34 years. Many of our neighbors have lived there longer, if not longer, than we have. On any given race night, the decibel level at my home, which is about a half a mile from Deer Creek Speedway, and if you look at the front page of that pamphlet that he sent out, look under the letter M. That's my house. And if you would see that we have a very large woods in between us. We have the decibel level reads at least 80 decibels. We have a handheld monitor that we have checked with the state because a deputy in our county was trained by, I believe, Mr. Timerson. He didn't come down last year. I'm sorry, in 2005. They did not do any recordings in 2006. And had monitoring, so we know that our handheld monitor is within a decibel. There are many nights I have recorded over 90 decibels in my backyard. And before I go any farther, could you explain to them what 90 decibels is like? It's hard for me to explain to Mr. Timerson.
Mr. Timerson. Mr. Chair, representatives, for purposes of trying to put in perspective decibel levels, probably the best way to do it would be to relay that a 10 decibel increase would sound twice as loud. So if somebody is saying a level is at 60 and comparing it to a level at 70, 70 would sound to the human ear twice as loud. So if a limit is, let's say, at 90 compared to 70, the 90 is four times as loud as 70. It's a logarithmic scale. So a 5 decibel increase is noticeable. 10 decibels is quite noticeable. Sounds twice as loud.
And as we're speaking right now, is approximately what decibel? Just to give a guess.
Normal conversational speech at 5 feet is somewhere around 60 to 65 decibels. It's hard to describe in a room with microphones and things, but that's generally what normal conversational speech is considered to be at 3 feet, 60 to 65 decibels.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I was just going to ask, the committee ends officially at 5:30, and there are some members that do have previous commitments. So,
okay.
So, thank you.
I will go quickly to my handout. Mr. Queensland built the billboard last year telling potential buyers that it would help cut down the noise pollution emitted from the local racetrack. That is also a copy of that in my handout. The cost is $3,000 a year, a billboard, and a 2-year minimum contract. Deb O'Connor from the Pioneer Press looked into the specifications of the billboard. It was, she was told by Dave Orfield, a sound barrier expert, the barrier would have little or no effect. There's 20 billboards in all. I know there's a couple other people that like to speak, so I will hurry. I found out last week that I have breast cancer. My family and my home took on a whole new meaning. If this bill goes through, I will not be, this will take away my summer again. That is every Saturday night plus special races from April to September that I cannot be in my own home or have my grandchildren, my family, my friends with me when I need them the most. The stress of having to listen to this constant of the race cars is going to really not help my situation at all. I do really ask that you guys, if you cannot at least say no to this bill, accept the race car standards, because any of us, I don't know about the other people at the track. I don't live there. I can't vouch for Alexander. I can't vouch for any other racetrack around. Our home life is horrible on a racetrack. We cannot have a conversation in our backyard listening to this. Mr. Queensland said that, yes, they're putting mufflers on. He told us this 2 or 3 years ago when we had a conversation with him. I'm sorry, but a straight pipe with a bunch of steel wool stuff in it is not a muffler. If the noise doesn't get down and we cannot do anything about it to save our homes, I really don't know what we're going to do. We have lived there for 34 years. This is our home. We don't want to leave. Neither do everybody else. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Gettleman? Well, thank you for testifying. I apologize for the shortness of time. I understand there are a couple others that would like to add something. Yeah, if everyone wants to testify, I could come forward in the interest of time. And if you could state your name and for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Anderson. My residence is Eden Prairie, but I have property in Spring Valley. I am a part of the action as well.
Okay. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I have some handouts, and I apologize for not having something for everybody, but there's some things I just want to call attention to, and it's not only the noise level, but it's also the health hazard that goes along with the noise level. My background, my training is medical, and just the things that I found on the internet from the World Health Organization, standards that have been laid down by the EPA before it was transferred over to the state authorities, lays it down at around 55 decibels. So that's quieter than normal, but psychologically, physiologically, it can be affected with increased noise. I've got some handouts, like I said. I apologize for not having all of them here. There's also a white paper that is available online that cites what the standards laid down by the World Health Organization and the EPA were. The higher decibel levels are showed to affect health. That's a given. In every state in the union, it's illegal to run without mufflers. Why do we do it here? If somebody drives by Deer Creek Speedway and they don't have a muffler on, they're going to get ticketed. But yet those cars running around that oval, they're running wide open, no mufflers. The exhaust, the fumes, the oil, it's air, it's water, as Deb pointed out earlier. That's noise pollution. We have to be cognizant of the surrounding area. And we're stewards of the land. We have to take care of the people. Now, are we here for a few, or are we here for them? If we've got all these racetracks that could be grandfathered into this, and we go to future, the question was, what about future tracks? Are they going to be back here in 5 years asking for the same exemption? Is that going to happen? Sure it is. Of course it is. We know it is. Human nature. If this were going to happen in the metro, right out there, I've looked at the statutes for Minneapolis and St. Paul. I can guarantee you, I fly all the time. I live in the air. I know it would never happen in this community. The people would not allow it. So why is it jammed down the throat of rural Minnesota just because there's a few people? Does it make sense? I have some questions. I want to give it to Rick here. So I just have some questions I want you to think about. Where is the monitoring of the carcinogens in the water, ground, and the air? Where is it? There's not. I've never heard of any. Where is the environmental impact study? One was never done for this property. There was never a CUP, and the permits do not cover what is there right now. Near a local track that I'm familiar with, which is Deer Creek, I joined this action because of all of the 5-gallon jugs of used oil, the flat containers that I saw come downstream were right here. That's why I joined this suit. Now, I can't prove that they came from there, but they can't prove they didn't. That appalls me. What else do I have there? OSHA regs. What about the people? We're talking 95 dB and 100 feet. What about the people that are right here at the track? Has OSHA come in and taken a look at these tracks? And where's their monitoring on the employees that are working at the track? We have standards for that. Now, this track resides in Moore County. All of these people not all of them, but a lot of it's in Fillmore County too. You're not hearing much from the Fillmore County commissions. Where are they in this action? A lot of the comments and a lot of complaints have gone to the Fillmore County Sheriff's Department. Nobody's contacted them. We're not talking about Fillmore County. This is 1 mile from the Moore County border, Moore Fillmore County border. I think we were touched upon how many police visits came to the track in the last couple of years. How many times were they called? What was done? Okay, they'll take the ticket. That track is making 10, 20, 30K a night on a race. What's a $100 ticket going to be? Nothing. Now, my question is, the action that's being taken here of exempting three tracts, maybe we should be looking at it the other way. Maybe we should look at those other 31 tracts. We're talking about controlling smoking in the environment. We're talking about everything that's bad for the public. But we're exempting somebody so they can go out and make more of a profit. What about the people that are surrounded? Isn't this this governing body about the people, not the individuals? What about the people? And why can't mufflers be added? They're talking about muffler. Like Deb said, little steel wool and a straight pipe. We used to be able to do that in my shop when I was a kid. we talked about future and the Mac itself, soundproof thing. Your point, Congressman, representative. Is Mr. Queensland ready to go out and soundproof all the homes around here to make them compatible? Mac has stopped doing it. It's just cost prohibitive. What about Mr. Queensland? And at 1,500 feet, it's still 95 decibels inside with the windows closed. Come on. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hyland.
Mr. Thurman, my name is Rick Hyland. I live 3/4 of a mile away from the track. And with a handheld decibel meter, I have registered 85 decibels at my place. I have lived there for 24 years in the same area for 26. Since the track has started, it started out as a small dirt track, maybe 12 to 16 races a year or a season. It has grown to 30 or more races a season. That's every Saturday night from the 1st of November or 1st of April to the 1st of October. It's unlivable. It affects the quality of life. After so many hours, the children and adults all get aggravated. It's, even this is aggravating. This is a stress deal, having to come up here 2 years in a row to do this. I don't think it's ever going to end, but if you guys open the gate to allow them to go to 95 decibels is what they're going to set on themselves. The reason why is they can't hardly get over that with straight pipes on. These cars all run headers, no mufflers, and no catalytic converters. Now, we've got all this greenhouse effect going on, and Minnesota prides itself in being first, you know, anymore. So now why aren't we doing something about this? To make it short and sweet, I know you guys got to get going. I just ask you not to open the gate. And one other point, comparing a racetrack to a gun range is like comparing a .22 rifle report to a sonic boom. If any of you have any questions, I'd appreciate talking to you after a while, but I know you guys have to get going, and I've never done this before, and I'm getting a little nervous about it, so thank you very much for sticking with me on this.
Thank you, Mr. Hyland.
Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd love to answer.
Any questions at all?
No. Okay.
Seeing no questions, thanks for coming, and one more, Mr. Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities would like to testify. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I can be very brief. I was asked to come in to comment on how this might or might not affect local government authority to regulate through land use planning or zoning ordinance motor vehicle racetracks and events. Would like to thank both Representative Poppy, this year's author, and Representative Hackbarth, who carried this bill last year. The original language of this bill did have some restrictions on local ability to regulate through ordinance or zoning. Those have been removed. Those concerns were addressed in this bill. And so what remains does not change current local authority to regulate or to do land use planning or zoning. You can see lines 120 through the end of the bill actually address that, saying that nothing prohibits a local unit of government from using those powers related to a racetrack. So it does not make any changes to that at this time. Mr. Chair, I could also add one clarifying comment in the question related to shooting range liability exemptions. Myself and Mr. Sulem from Townships, who's in the audience, worked on crafting that bill with Representative Hackbarth. The exemption from nuisance liability for shooting ranges is a rebuttable presumption that as long as the range is not demonstrated to be in violation of its operating standards, which include an impulse noise standard, they are presumed to not be a nuisance. But if you can prove that they have violated their noise standard and are in violation of operating performance operating standards, they could then theoretically be subject to a nuisance claim. That's the only case where they could, for noise.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? Representative Moe.
Just a quick question for Mr. Johnson. So, Mr. Johnson, so local units of government could still choose to regulate this facility given current law, correct, regardless of what we do here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, A local unit of government on this specific facility, I don't know all of the details, but a local unit of government can have a conditional use permit that sets operating standards. You cannot go back and have a facility have less ability to operate now than it previously had. That would be a taking. But you could reach an agreement that what they do now could not be, the county down there could reach a conditional use permit agreement that current operating is the furthest they could go, or they could set other standards for lighting, for traffic, for dust, for other operational impacts of the facility. But none of that is restricted in here. And of course, existing other racetracks around the state, most of those, I would guess, do have some sort of conditional use permit attached to them. I don't know the details on them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other questions? I do have one question for clarification, and I don't know who's the best to direct this question towards, but I think it's important for members to know about the lawsuit provision, what that exempts exactly. Is it just lawsuits pertaining to noise, or are there other factors that are also exempted in that provision of this bill? I don't know, Mr. Helen, if you can help us, or Representative Poppy?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's claims based on noise brought under the nuisance law, which is 560-101. Chapter 116B is the Environmental Rights Act, where citizens can bring civil action for pollution, impairment, or destruction of the environment. And 116D is related to requiring environmental impact statements for governmental action. But they're all based on noise, based as shown on law. 19 and 20 in the first page.
Okay, so that doesn't, it does deal with sections pertaining to pollution and environmental destruction, but
based
it doesn't.
Based on noise.
Based on noise. Okay, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. So, any other questions at all? Representative Poppy, do you have any other comments?
We'd appreciate your moving approval of this and moving it on to the next committee, which would be the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Yes, Representative.
I'd like to renew my motion to pass this bill on to public safety.
We do have an amendment before us. If Representative Mariani would like to move his amendment before.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the motion and hear the amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dill. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure, because I know you've run out of time, how much further you want to go. It's obviously the prerogative of the chair, but I would move my amendment 415A2. This amendment goes to the issue of the language accepting from claims, and I had a visit with Representative Poppy earlier this afternoon and had a good discussion. I've since then spoken with several other members on the committee. I think that unfortunately it seems to me, Mr. Chair, that to some degree, the state is kind of being brought along into a discussion that, this is sort of a little bit of an aside. It seems to me that, there should have been some more local oversight over what's going on in this particular case. When that doesn't happen, it really invites the state to step in. And so I want to make sure that if we are stepping in, in as tightly constructed a manner as possible. We do have a legal business operating, legal business operating around the state, and so I don't want to, carry any particular biases for or against those businesses. However, I think that, as Representative Wagini has pointed out, that, there's a couple of issues here related to constraint ideas. Part of the reason why we have the ability to file claims is precisely when situations, perhaps when our local elected officials or our state officials fail to act. In our democracy, we allow our citizens to move forward in a civil manner. And if we bar that, we would tend to bar that, pretty restrictively, I think. Obviously, these are issues that civil law can talk about. But I'm really concerned that this committee really be able to be in a position where we're not setting any kind of precedent here in regards to these kind of facilities and related facilities. And we do have other facilities mentioned in the overall statute here. And it does worry me that if we carve out an exemption here, that we may be seeing other requests in the future. And that is within the purview it seems to me, of this committee and less so than the purview of the Civil Law Committee. And so, members, what this amendment would do is basically keep the grandfathering position in. We've heard testimony against that as well, and I have some discomfort with that, but what this amendment would do is just focus in on the civil suit, the bar to the civil suit. I think that if, in fact, it seems to me that if, in fact, these industries are working well with their locals, that they're going to work these things out. I hate to predetermine or predecide, you know, for every community whether or not they shouldn't have their day in court in regards to these issues. So, Mr. Chair, members, it's within that spirit, a tough issue, but it's within that spirit I would offer this amendment at this time.
Any discussion to Representative Mariani's amendment?
No.
Not at this point. So,
well, Mr. Chair, do we have the amendment? Do I have the amendment?
Look through.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could the author speak to the amendment? My understanding of Representative Mariani's amendment is this would remove the majority of what you're trying to accomplish here. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Moe. As I began in the beginning, there are two parts to this bill. One is the change of the date, which is the fairness issue, and the second part is really, I'm talking about the economic issue, and that impacts all of the racetracks throughout the state. So taking out this language does would allow for these civil suits to be able to come, and that could destroy some of the businesses that are racetracks throughout the state of Minnesota.
Any other questions? Okay, with that, Representative Mariani renews his motion to pass Amendment H0415A2. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay.
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Amendment
Division.
Division has been called. Roll will be taken.
No, just a show of hands.
Oh, all those in favor, signify by raising your hands. All those opposed? Vote is 7 ayes and 9 nays. Motion does not prevail.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to move the bill to public safety.
Representative Dale renews his motion to move House File 415 to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification question, and I apologize. We have so many new committees, I'm not sure, you know, what the scope of all the other committees, but there are civil law issues that are present in this bill in regards to the language that I had just attempted to amend. Would this committee have the purview to review that civil law language? It used to be we had a civil law division. I guess I'm not sure what we have.
Mr. Hillings? Sure. I've been told that Representative Mulery has requested the bill.
And Mr. Chair, is that the committee we're referring the bill to, or is it making
it? Yes.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Okay, again, with that, Representative Dill renews his motion that the bill be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is adopted and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
with that, we'll adjourn until Thursday.